final hour of Bob Gross and Tom. A reminder to listen to our show via the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealers. We'll eavesdrop coming up at the bottom of the hour, but right now we speak to the one, the only, Professor John Clayton. Hello, John.
Hello, guys.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. You know, we spent a fair amount of time this morning talking about the situation with the Seahawks and Malik McDowell. Now, are there hard feelings here? Did something happen between... It seemed like after the accident, he was there at the facility. They were interacting. Pete would comment on him and whatever. And now them going after his money with interest seems like there's a vendetta. There's some level of vengeance. Did something happen?
No, it's just business because, you know, he signs the contract and he has the accident. He doesn't play. And when they put him on NFI, it gives the team ability to get money back at some point. Now, again, a second-round pick is going to have his first and second-year base salary guaranteed, and he's going to get a signing bonus. So what they ended up doing is that when they redid the contract right before the start of this training camp, they took his pay down to $85,000. They paid him, you know, 5 times 17 weeks. And so instead of making $495,000, knowing he wasn't going to play, they did that. But he still had his signing bonus. And so then what ends up happening, because he had a guarantee in his contract the second year, they basically kept him on the roster, so he was able to at least keep the second proration of his signing bonus. So he was able to keep half the proration, but they also voided his salary, so he didn't make any cash as far as that goes. So he still had 2 years of proration, and so they want that back. You know, they already said that you got the $800,000, so they wanted another $800,000. It's just business. You know,
John, they're suing him in federal court, though.
Yeah.
This is how many teams have done that with players before?
It's happened a couple times. I mean, normally it doesn't get to that point, but then you wonder, does he have any money to pay it back? Because, you know, and you know, you can take it to a grievance and the Players Association jumps in and all those things. But, you know, in a federal court, because clearly, you know, with him being a Michigan guy, he wasn't going to be living here in Seattle. So you couldn't go with a local court or at least a state court here in the state of Washington. So you had to go into a federal court because here you're a Washington-based company and he's a Michigan-based person. So that's why I had to go to federal court, but it had to go into some kind of a court. And so now it's a matter that they win, the arbiter rules in the favor. He doesn't fight it too much, but I don't know if he has the money to be able to pay it back. And if they get the money back, they can get cap relief from that next year. But right now you don't know if he's going to be able to pay it.
Wait, hold on. If they get the money back, like he writes him a check, they get cap relief?
Not immediately, but they'll get it the next year.
So if he doesn't have the money, then they don't get cap relief?
That would be correct.
Wow.
How can that be?
It's a simple thing. I mean, every dollar of the cap is accounted for, and if you get the money back, then you're able to take it off the cap at the next convenient time, which would be next year. And so that's just the way that the collective bargaining agreement works. I mean, again, every dollar is accounted for. And so if you paid the money, then it counts against the cap. If you get the money back, then it comes back to you in a cap relief.
I guess on the surface, when you're talking about the massive amounts of money that are generated and made and thrown around in the NFL, when you see a team go after a guy who's been involved in an accident, can't play, and it's for a little under $800,000, that's $20 to you and I, $10 to you and I. It feels petty on some level. I'm not saying they shouldn't do it or he's earned it or anything. It just feels weird that they'd take it to court and they would spend whatever it's going to cost them in legal fees to go through this whole process for less than $800,000.
Yeah, but remember, I think a part of this is that they're asking him to pay the court costs and all that.
Well, if he didn't have the money to pay in the first place, how can he pay the court costs?
That's up to him to figure out. I mean, it's up to the courts to give the Seahawks the ability to do that. But again, they're mad at him? Well, certainly they're disappointed because they put a second round pick in him. They lost $1.6 million and $85,000. That was something they can't recoup. But they had the ability to recoup $1.6 million, which again, I think it's more the cap than it is the money. But remember, I mean, you can basically say once he had the accident, the player and the team basically had no relationship.
Are the Seahawks, is part of this that they're on the field, the defensive line that they have, the pass rush situation, they're still basically paying for the Malik McDowell failure? I mean, the situation they're in right now is because the Malik McDowell thing didn't work out. Is there resentment there?
I'm sure there's a disappointment because, again, you've invested a second-round pick in somebody who did not play. I mean, I don't think it's vicious. Again, it's just, I think, pure business more than anything else. Now, understand, with the way that they were able to work it, you know, they were still able to get three starters out of the Malik McDowell situation. They wanted to take him at the 25th pick, but they make three trades down, and actually they got four players for him. Three of them ended up being starters. One was Shaquille Griffin, the cornerback. Another, they were able to get Tedrick Thompson, who ended up starting at safety, and they got Chris Carson. And so even though it was a disappointment, even though it was a bad pick, you know, and certainly, you know, I know when they took him, I mean, he was supposed to be a top five, top six player, but, you know, he had the off-the-field issues that kind of made teams worry about that. That's why he was available that low at 35. But, you know, once he had the accident and his bad judgment, you know, then they put him in a position where it's like, okay, whatever relationship was there was none.
Hey, did you hear any more about what his interview was like with the Cowboys? I mean, is he looked at as physically unable to play, or what's the word on him after that?
Well, you know, Drew Rosenhaus's agent said that an independent doctor has cleared him to play, but apparently the Cowboys, you know, didn't feel good about it because they're still looking for defensive tackle help, and they just let him go and didn't do anything with him, and no team has looked at him since. So you kind of wonder, it's like, and, you know, when it's brought up to Pete Carroll, not that he's, I mean, you could see he kind of laughed about it, saying, oh, yeah, Drew Rosenhaus said that he's cleared to play. And it's like, oh, yeah, we'll see about that one type of comment.
That's your injury report brought to you by IRG Physical and Hand Therapy.
Hey, John, have the Seahawks done business any differently since Paul Allen passed away?
Not really, no. I think that basically Paul gave both Pete Carroll and John Snyder to operate the best they can. I think the only difference now is that they have to be a little bit more attentive to the budget, but I think anything that they ask for from Jody Allen, they're able to get. I mean, you notice they had no issue being willing to pay $9 million for Ziggy Ansah. They were able to work that one out. And then, you know, they have a budget. And they have to adhere to the budget probably a little bit more than Paul made him adhere to it. Not that Paul restricted him in any ways. But, no, I think it's just now because, you know, you have to kind of be a little bit more presentive of what the plan is, because, you know, you got the, you know, Jody kind of running things, and it's not just going to Paul and saying, okay, here, this and this. But no, I think they're operating pretty much the same way, because the football people were making the football decisions.
How hard do you think it is to just, and I don't know what her involvement was before, but how hard do you think it is to just step in and run a football team?
It's not easy, but you know, understand that she's kind of now involved in three franchises, and
right.
What you're seeing league-wide is that there's a growing number of women that through whatever, you know, passings and things of that nature are getting an opportunity to run things. You see it with Tom Benson's wife in New Orleans, you know, running the an arena team. They have the NBA team, and then they have the Saints. I mean, you got Denver, Tennessee. There's about six owners right now that are being run by women, and they all seem to be doing pretty well. I know I was talking to Roger Goodell at the owners meeting about that, because it was a story that I was kind of pushing for the Washington Post, and they said absolutely, because, I mean, they're having some great successes, and particularly, I mean, the one that seems to be getting a lot of rave reviews, along with Jody Allen, is Tom Benson's wife.
Hey, we were talking earlier about Chris Long's stance on marijuana. He's been very vocal about it, talking about using it throughout his career when he was playing. Obviously, it's got a lot of health benefits, but there's still a very antiquated, old-school view of it in the eyes of a lot of people, despite the evidence that's out there that shows alcohol a decidedly more destructive drug than marijuana. Yet, you know, they're huge sponsors of the game, everything. Do you see the NFL coming around on this and sort of embracing it and understanding the benefits it could provide to some of the players, or do you think the antiquated view of it is going to be just that because most of the owners are older guys that hold those views?
Well, embracing it, no. Accepting it, yes. Because last week, the Players Association and the NFL worked out a joint agreement, and I hate to use the word joint on that. They're going to go into studies mutually and see the benefits of that and where to go with it. I mean, still, it's illegal to test for marijuana, and they start testing for marijuana on the this year it was going to be April 20th. And so now if you fail a marijuana test, you are going to get suspended. But in the future, they're going to try to mutually work on something and try to get some kind of an arrangement on that. You know, 25%, I think the 75%, I guess, right now of the cities that have National Football League teams do not have legalized marijuana, but it is growing. I think that, again, not that they're reluctant about it, but again, they're not fighting it now, but they did work on that agreement with the Players Association to try to move in that direction. And once they get everything figured out, then they will.
That's something that can be in the next collective bargaining agreement?
Before that, I think it depends. See, I'm the one optimistic on the collective bargaining agreement because I think that they'll get something done at the latest before the league year, before March of next year. And I noticed that Jason Lock and Flores, CBS, pretty much is saying the same thing because that's the vibe we're all hearing because negotiations have been civil. They are getting more cooperation with the NFL. I mean, the one thing that you can see that they're not getting acceptance on right now is Roger Goodell still ruling on player conduct and that. They may not win that battle, but the Players Association recognizes that there's so much big money that's going to be involved with television and streaming that they don't want to lose that by having the threat of a lockout. So I do think they're going to get something done.
What's the bigger issue there? Is it getting a cut of that, or is it just guaranteed money in general?
No, they're not even fighting as hard on the guaranteed money because they realize they're not going to be able to win that battle. So really what it comes down to, the only big battle is, you know, stadium credits, because the NFL owners ran out of stadium credits sometime in the middle of the Minnesota deal, and that's like 1.5% of the cap. So, and they want to make sure that they have that ability. And, of course, the players, you know, at least in trying to generate revenue, have been willing to, you know, put 1.5% into stadium credits. But again, they ran out, and the NFL wants to make up what was missing from the Minnesota deal and also make sure that they have a good allowance coming up in the next CBA. That's the only one right now that seems to be the biggest problem. And that's one that gets a little bit of tension in there. But from the guarantees, they realize the players aren't going to be able to get that. They realize there's not going to be an increase in the percentage going to the players. And, you know, they'll get some concessions on some things and some gains on others. But I think that you can see they're working together. They've had two sessions right now. Others are being planned. And unless something blows up, I think they'll get something done.
John Clayton is our guest, as he is every Friday at 2 o'clock here with Bob Gross and Tom. Well, we were talking yesterday, the day before, about the article that came out from our buddy Brady Henderson about the relationship between Doug Baldwin and Russell Wilson. And he talked about, I feel like he basically talked about a lot of what we already knew. There was some level of tension there, and Jake Heaps weighed in on it in that article. Some people took that as a big deal, and oh my goodness, they're not buddies off the field and don't go out to dinner. None of that should matter. They were incredibly productive, and they were number four on the ranking as far as quarterback receiver tandem since 2012, ahead of guys like Aaron Rodgers, ahead of guys like Drew Brees and Tom Brady. Yet some look at that as a big deal. I feel like that's very commonplace. How did you react to that?
I looked at it as that even though it may have been a contentious relationship, each pushed each other into being the best they could be. Now, you throw Richard Sherman in there, too, because I think that you could see that he was critical of Russell, too, and tried to push Russell. But Russell has now ended up having, you know, he's probably the best quarterback in Seahawk history. He's having a borderline Hall of Fame career, and, you know, he'll get more leadership now with Doug gone. But I think it worked out well. Doug arguably was the second best receiver in NFL history, or not NFL history, but Seahawk history, even though he was an undrafted player coming out of Stanford. So I think even though it was sometimes tough, the personalities may have clashed a little bit more from Doug's side to Russell's side. But in the end, it was one where they got the best out of each other.
Is the honeymoon over for Odell Beckham in Cleveland?
No, he'll find new ways to try to break it. But, you know, I mean, the only good thing, I guess, he's got that nice, $300,000 card dressed in Browns colors.
What?
He got, I can't remember what kind of car he got, but it was like a $300,000 car, and it's orange for the colors of the Cleveland Browns.
Ugh.
But, you know, the idea of him not being here at the OTAs is silly on his part because, you know, he's got a young quarterback in Baker Mayfield. It's not like Baker's been in the league for all this amount of time that he could just sit back and say, oh, yeah, I'm fine with you, Odell. I mean, they need to work together. So they'll work together at the minicamp, but I think, you know, this is Odell being selfish and not helping his teammate out by being there.
You know, talking about quarterback wide receiver relationships here, whether it's Baldwin or Wilson, I mean, you've covered the game forever. What's the worst quarterback wide receiver relationship you've ever seen that was productive?
Hines Ward and Ben Roethlisberger.
Really? They don't like each other? I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, Ben liked Hines. Hines didn't like Ben.
What was the problem?
Ben. It's like, that was a time where...
When Ben was nuts?
No, that wasn't nuts. It's just that's kind of the way it's been off and on with him through his career. Sometimes he's aloof. Sometimes he's good working with everybody. And sometimes he takes too much control. Like that's Antonio Brown and, I guess, Joey Porter's criticism. But there was a lot of guys in the early days of his career that didn't like Ben. Mm. The only thing that they liked is that from the very first year he came in 2004, they won football games. And so you can cover for those type of bad relationships or the bad responses that you get from your teammates by winning, and Ben was able to win, and so it worked. But no, I thought that relationship was pretty bad.
Hey, John, we saw this tweet from Andrew Hawkins, who looked at a clip of DK Metcalf running one particular play. It says, took 8 steps and a whole 5 yards to stop, has some work to do. Okay, that's one play that was isolated, and he came into this with the reputation of, hey, he doesn't run the best routes. It's one of the weaknesses he has. So to me, he's just sort of observing that one play and stating the obvious, but some took it as a, uh-oh, this kid's going to be trouble. He's not going to get it at this level. Did you take this as anything other than that? It's an observation on one play.
It's an observation on one play. All I know is that we've been able to watch him for, total of 5 days, and he looks good. I mean, yeah, there's going to be some plays where he's not going to look natural. He had a drop in Tuesday's OTA or Wednesday's OTA, but he's been catching the ball well. He's run better routes than I think anybody expected. And to take, one play and say, oh, yeah, I think I can get that judgment, where we've been able to watch, at least 40 plays or maybe 50 plays involving him, I don't think that I think that's an unfair criticism. Because, again, it's like you're looking at one thing and it may not have been his best, but what about the play on the right sidelines where he's, jumping 11 feet in the air and pulling the ball down? What about some of the plays where he's able to, just kind of use his footwork to get past cornerbacks? We've seen that.
Who was impressive in OTAs to you?
Russell Wilson, really, on his short passes, I don't know if he's doing something to get more velocity on the ball, but he was really zipping it. I mean, his long passes have always been good. They look as good as ever, if not maybe a little bit better. But looking at him throwing some of the short, like just taking the ball and going, boom, he was doing that. That looked good. I thought that Marquise Blair looked good trying to go on a couple of deep passes to try to, knock the ball down. Shaquille Griffin had a nice play downfield. I liked what I saw of Amara Darbo. I think he's had a couple of real good days that we've been able to see. So he's coming back. Certainly, everybody's really raving about Cody Barton and how natural he is in being able to pick up the defense and being able to move. He looks good. I think that you can see there's going to be some improvement in Jacob Martin. I mean, at the linebacker position, maybe not. And, he's using that. That looks good. But overall, I mean, it's a good draft class. There's a lot of speed at the receiver position. Another one that I thought would look good was Tyler Lockett. It put Tyler Lockett occasionally in the slot, and he looks very natural because he's now got the experience to be able to read what the defender is going to do and the type of defense it's going to be, and he's got the speed to be able to get open.
Did you flip out at the one questionable route that DK Metcalf ran the other day? Did you see that video?
Is that you talking about the one that Andrew Hawkins ripped?
Oh, yeah. Did you ask him about that already? Yeah. I'm sorry. Sorry.
I was trying to give Tom the sign, but he didn't see me.
Sorry about that. I was going to ask about Darbo and then changed it at the last second.
Go ahead and ask about Darbo.
Do you think Darbo's got a shot?
He does, yeah. I mean, I think everything is wide open. David Moore also looked good. I mean, really, I mean, there's so many positive things. Now, again, when you're talking about non-contact OTAs or non-contact rookie minicamps, I mean, the receivers are always going to have the advantage if they have speed and the ability to beat the corners, because at least they know where they're going and the quarterback knows where they're going and the cornerback's just trying to react. But I think the one thing that you can see, this is a fast group of wide receivers.
Hey, do you have any sense of what Nas Jones's role is going to be or what happened last year? Did he get in the doghouse? Because he is a healthy scratch more than a few times, and he was also a guy that was thought of very highly after the previous season. So I never really understood what happened last year, and I'm not sure how to feel about his chances this year.
No, that's easy to understand because, you have Nas Jones. He would be active when they're playing more passing type of teams because he's big and able to knock the ball down. And you notice those are the games where Puna Ford didn't play, and you know how much they talk about how much they love Puna Ford. Puna Ford was more available for the run teams. And so it was kind of back and forth in that regard as far how one was used and one wasn't used. Now it's a matter that Nas is in a big fight, just one, to try to make the team, and two, to get playing time. And so he's fighting a little bit of a knee injury right now. I mean, Puna Ford right now, they're raving about. They really think he's going to make a big jump this year. And, of course, if he does, that's probably going to come at Nas Jones's expense.
Much like Odell Beckham, Le'Veon Bell's making friends at his new home, isn't he?
Oh, he's doing great. Unbelievable. I mean, isn't that sad?
I'm not sure.
I don't know if it's sad. It just seems weird.
It is weird. Well, because, you know.
Even have a teammate trying to, right? Didn't someone advocate for him to come and he still doesn't?
No, and it's like he's relying on his own judgment, and his judgment is, I'm going to be down here in Miami, and I'm going to get my body right, and I'm going to come up there and have a great year, just like it's like, oh, I need to save my body last year so that I can be a big free agent and get $18 million as a wide receiver-type running back. That didn't work. He misses $14.5 million. He only gets $13.1, and now he goes to a coach that doesn't like to pay running backs. And so we'll see how this works out. But all he's doing is putting more pressure on himself and probably shortening his stay with the New York Jets. I mean, they won't trade him this year, but if Adam Gase gets the GM he wants and has control of personnel, you know that he's going to be tried and getting out of that contract.
I saw a story, John, that said Adam Gase has Sam Darnold looking at Peyton Manning film, which makes sense, but he's also got him looking at Jay Cutler film. Is that a good idea?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because, I mean, look at the success that Adam had with Jay Cutler. I mean, Jay Cutler was about as good with Adam Gase as he was with any other coach. And so, you know, there's a good talent there with Jay Cutler. And I'm sure that he didn't show him the film, you know, of him reacting negatively to the players when they didn't block right for him. But I think that you can see that what he was able to do throwing-wise and what Adam was able to do with him is one that it was probably good to be able to show him that. And so, no, I think that that's a wise thing to do, because what Adam is trying to do is saying, here's what I've done with the quarterbacks that I've worked with, and here's the good things, and here's the things I think that you can copy.
You know, Jay Cutler only had a career passer rating over 90 one time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just want you to know that.
He knew that.
Well, I'm not. Let's put it this way. I mean, you can only go to the tape that you have, and you know, Adam has, you know, he did have success with Jay. I mean, maybe not as much in Miami when he came to fill in for an injured Ryan Tannehill, but you know, Jay did do some good things in Chicago the 1 year the two of them were together. Hmm.
John, you doing your show tomorrow?
Yes, indeed. Taking calls from 8 until 9.
There you go, John. Always appreciate it. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks,
okay,
John.
Thank you.
There you go. The Professor John Clayton with us every Friday at 2 o'clock.
We forgot to ask about DK Metcalf.
Yeah. Wonder what he thought about that route.
Shoot.
I like that you knew right away when I was looking at you, you're like, oh.
You gave me the look. Ah, shoot.
So, Amara Darbo. All right. Meanwhile, a head coach cried at a press conference and the media applauded. We're going to eavesdrop on that next with Bob Gross and Tom on 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time now for the eavesdrop.
It is time for the eavesdrop here with Bob Gross and Tom. We take a listen to something somebody said somewhere about stuff.
Let me play this because we're going to have to jump around this bite a little bit. We watched it this morning. You want to explain what it is first?
Well, it was Michigan has a new head coach for their basketball team, a man I think most people are familiar with if you paid any attention to
he's a Michigan
college basketball
man.
Or the NBA, because he's had a strong presence in both, and that would be Juwan Howard.
Long career.
Really long
in the
career.
NBA.
Productive player.
Very.
Not a superstar,
like
but
a
really
backup
good
big
player.
Man.
He was first head coaching job at his alma mater.
In the, what, the 14th head coach of Michigan, I believe.
That's all?
That's what they said, yeah.
Wow.
Maybe that's about right.
Yeah. So he comes in, obviously, with a great passion for the program and Fab Five, incredibly popular there, and he was had his introductory press conference, and he was beyond emotional. You expect, maybe a little choked up or anything. I mean, he let it go.
Yeah, the first 45 seconds or so, he actually couldn't speak, and this is what happened.
Congratulations, man.
Whoever was in the room, whether it was alumni or press or whoever it was, just stood there and gave him an ovation.
Yeah, he got up there and started really crying and turned his back to everybody, just turned around and faced the wall, trying to get his composure. And then, and everybody started applauding. So, I don't know if there
would have had a lot of people in the – it would have been a lot of the basketball staff and
– and maybe friends, family, etc.
Usually at things like that, it's members of the staff.
Mm-hmm. Or was it just the other four of the Fab Five?
It was just Chris Webber.
Webber, Rose, King. Yeah, they're out there clapping.
And then he went on.
Thank you, everyone. I said I wasn't going to cry. Guess that never happens when you're excited about something that's so special to you, that means so much. Last time I had a press conference in this building was 1994. I declared that I was going to go to the NBA. Felt like I was letting down my teammates because I didn't do what I came here to do. And that was to bring a championship to this university. A university that I care so much about. I guess you can see that now, huh? Now let's fast forward 25 years later.
And here we are.
Yeah, good for him.
Yeah. You know, as he's saying that there, he said in 1994, I felt like I was letting my teammates down because we didn't accomplish what we set out to do, which is win a championship. Have you ever guys seen that, or have you guys ever seen that series on the NFL Network, The Missing Rings? Do you know what that is?
No. Mm-hmm.
It's like they do an hour-long special on teams that came just this close that should have won a Super Bowl ring. Right. Teams like the Buffalo 98 Bills. Vikings, right, the 07 Patriots, certainly the Bills, the whoever. When you think about those teams, even in other sports, the Fab Five really should have been one of those teams.
Well, they got the two Final Fours.
They got the two, I think, did they get to? No, yeah, right. Two Final Fours, one national championship.
Right.
Because Duke beat them in 92, I believe. But, yeah, they're definitely one of those teams. And sports are littered with those. But for him to have the opportunity now to come back and to take over a program that's as strong as any in the country.
I meant to ask Bradley about him because and I'm wishing him nothing but good luck. But,
yeah. I mean, I'm not.
Boy,
but, yeah.
This is a guy who's never coached in college. He's been an assistant coach in the NBA. Taking over not just the program, his alma mater, which, just like you said, Tom, under John Beilein, has been terrific.
Yeah. I mean, the last 10 years or so, they're as good a program as there's been.
Yeah.
How many of the kids that he'll be recruiting are going to be aware of who he is?
None.
Just historically speaking. Like,
him,
yeah,
specifically, or the five, or the Fab Five?
Just knowledge.
Their parents will know.
The parents will tell them, but, I mean, how many, I guess, the wow factor, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Jalen Rose is here. Juwan Howard's here. Like, just knowing that this was a guy who had a tremendous reputation there and went on to the NBA. Or are they going to look at him as, who's the old guy? He's the coach? Okay, cool. And the parent, like you said, the parents probably say, hey, no.
More of that than the more guys would just be, oh.
Have no idea who he is.
Unfortunately.
I don't know.
Know who Jalen Rose is because they watch the NBA.
Right. Well, maybe Jalen can help him out.
Maybe he can.
Well, you'd think they'd leave no stone unturned because they're all on board with him being hired there and very excited so much that it's building bridges between Jalen and Chris Webber,
right,
who otherwise had no use for each other.
Well, they'll be back in the news, so kids will see that for sure.
You could ask the same question about Penny Hardaway at Memphis.
Yeah.
Or the kids who were going to Memphis, did they ever, I mean, it wasn't even called Memphis. Wasn't it Memphis State when he was there?
It was.
Pretty sure it was. I mean.
Was it State?
Yeah.
Memphis State for years.
I think it was Memphis State. But
you don't think they saw the Chris Rock commercials with Little Penny?
No, I don't think they saw Blue Chips either. Actually, you know what? For any kid who's being recruited, hopefully they've seen the movie Blue Chips.
Right.
Then they're going to expect a tractor. They're going to expect a whole bag of cash. They're going to expect
right.
All that cool stuff that they saw happen.
For Neon.
Neon Boudreaux.
He didn't even want the car.
Neon Boudreaux.
There was another crying incident, by the way, this week from a professional athlete, and I can play you some of that. But you guys saw this. Is it Albert Almora who plays for the Cubs?
Yes. Yeah.
So he hit a line drive into the stands, obviously a foul ball, and it struck a young girl. And he became very, very emotional about it.
I think he started crying on the field.
Right, he did. And the audio we're about to play here came from after the game, and I'll give you some more in a second. But this is, I think, the main point of what he's saying. Just a quick bite here.
Right now, I want to put a net around the whole stadium.
I thought for years.
What did he say? I want to put what?
A net around the whole stadium.
Net around the whole stadium.
I thought for years that it's very strange that up the baselines, essentially all the way down to the foul pole, it's weird that there's no netting and that there's not more protection, because especially in an era where everybody's looking at cell phones, if you're not looking, you're in big trouble down there.
Yeah, I've sat down there before with friends. I know you guys have sat there. It is amazing how many people are either turned away from the action, talking to their friend or whoever, or looking at the phone. You're just going, man, we are a split second from somebody just getting cracked right in the head because the ball's on you immediately.
Yep.
I mean, there should be netting all the way around.
I mean, there's netting.
I'm curious to see who's going to be the first team to do it.
Well, they've expanded it at T-Mobile, I believe.
They extended it everywhere.
Right, but not as far as it needs to go.
It's coming.
A little bit more from Al Mora.
All my teammates, Joe, everybody came out and obviously tried to talk to me. And obviously, I didn't want that to happen, and I didn't intend for that to happen. Credit to Miley as well. Came to me and said, you know, try to calm me down. And the rest was kind of a blur. The rest of that at bat, I finally came to my senses after the next half inning when I went over to the stands.
I mean, I don't know what happened on the next pitch, but can you imagine if he fouled off another pitch?
Man,
exactly.
Yeah, and they talked about him going up and talking to one of the ushers or security guards there, like trying to get information on the little girl, and then I guess he and the security guard were hugging and everything. Mm-hmm. You feel terrible, obviously, for the little girl, but a player like that who's not your intention.
Of course not.
And it's just a really unfortunate side effect of baseball. It can happen.
It's amazing it doesn't happen more. And I know that there are a lot of incidents that just aren't reported and we don't hear about them, because why would we?
Well, think of how often you see a line drive hit into the crowd.
Yes.
Or a bat get thrown. You know, they lose control of the bat and
now,
it goes flying.
Everyone's televising everything, so you're seeing it on the major league level. But there's no reason to take the chance.
No, there isn't. I mean, when there's a home run hit and the whole crowd kind of comes to life and the ball's in the air and it's not a line drive, that's one thing. I mean, somebody out there is going to try and reach for the ball. You kind of the crowd ends up kind of protecting itself.
Well,
in
even
that
with
situation.
A net, you're still going to get those pop foul balls,
right?
You're still going to. It's not like it eliminates anybody's opportunity for a souvenir there, but you'll get it on the high pop up that goes in the crowd. You'll still get those,
right? You'll get those, and again, everybody will protect one another because people will go up and they'll try to catch it when it's a line drive and it's coming right at you.
Scary, man.
I mean, they warn you about it. They say it over the PA. You know, they say to
be
aware,
then it could still happen.
I know.
Did we talk about it, or maybe I saw it on Real Sports in Japan? They've got an area where they've got seats that are all in that area, and they've got mitts at the seats.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
smart.
I think they've got netting and they've got mitts that you sit down. Here's a mitt, like be ready
just in case. Yeah. I would be holding that thing up to if I had a young kid. Well, first of all, I would probably position myself so I'm sitting in front of the kid, but
yeah.
I'd be holding that up right alongside their head.
Man, scary. Scary thing. All right, we are going to come back. We will sum it all up next with Bob Gross and Tom on 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time to sum it up with Bob Gross and Tom.
Brought to you by Heritage Distillings BSB, Brown Sugar Bourbon.
The final word every day on the show of record at 2:45.
We don't have another giveaway today.
I don't see one on the sheet.
Guess not. We gave away so much yesterday, I guess we don't have to give away anymore.
Yeah, we made so many people happy yesterday.
Right. The only reason I ask is because usually on Friday we have something.
We almost always do, it seems.
Yeah. Something foul is afoot.
You think so?
Budget restrictions?
An oversight, perhaps? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
If that's the case, I'm sure we'll double up next week. Hopefully it wasn't for anything taking place this weekend, though.
No, well,
that could be problematic.
Yeah, we'll have to come up with something else. I'll take somebody sailing or something.
There you go.
We've talked a bunch of NBA this week, and we talked to Jack Sikma yesterday, which was really cool. And in preparation for that that interview, I was kind of in a YouTube rabbit hole there, or wormhole, whatever you call it. And I came across a video. I think it was because of the Sikma move. I came across a video on the Eurostep.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm watching that, I started wondering, what is so innovative about that move that it really didn't appear in the NBA until it was brought over from Europe? It's just a move. It's just like a juke, essentially.
It's like,
yeah, you go one way, you go the other. I mean, how could
something they've perfected is like the Hakeem Olajuwon dream shake.
Okay.
Well, I mean,
you know,
but
it doesn't look like this big elaborate move, but it was remarkably effective and got the defender off of you, got him off guard. I'm off balance.
I could argue that the most effective move in NBA history is not
Skyhook.
Yeah.
Okay, I agree with that.
Which used to be used and is simple, and no one uses it.
Who else besides Kareem would use that?
Magic used it sometimes.
Did he?
Well, if you go before, you had, I mean, Bob Lanier, I mean, that era, lots of those guys shot it.
Yeah. It's just
it was the hook shot.
The move itself, to me, It seems like something that you would do anyway. And believe me, Bob, you see me play basketball. I'm not one to judge, like to jump in here and say, well, why weren't you guys doing that back in the 70s?
Yeah, watching you dribble was fun.
It's not that at all. It's just that it seems like as you're attacking the basket, it's something that would occur to you naturally anyway, but I guess not.
Everyone wants to shoot three or dunk.
Well, now.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, tomorrow's the 40-year anniversary, officially.
Of the Sonics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're having the day at the ballpark, but it happens to be the actual date.
Right.
Our colleague Percy Allen wrote a nice piece in the Times about it.
Anything you want to share?
No, it's a secret.
That's what I'm sharing.
No, I mean about the article. Anything that jumped out to you?
And it's something that I don't know if Jack brought it up with us, but he brought it up at the roast that I went to. The biggest game of that year may have been Game 6 against Phoenix.
Okay.
They had lost. They were down. They had won the first two games. They'd lost three straight. Were down 3-2. Phoenix had won 10 straight playoff games at home, and they won the game. I think Phoenix missed the last second shot, and that was probably the biggest win. It paved the way for everything.
And they had lost the year before.
Yeah, they'd lost the finals the year before, and that paved the way for them to play the Bullets in the finals again.
You know, we don't talk a ton about that 79 team in the same way we do, say, 95 with the Mariners when they didn't even win a championship. But if they hadn't won that championship in 79, how much different would our culture around here be, our sports culture? Because that was the one major sport championship that at least could be clung to here. Yeah, until 2013.
Yep.
I mean, I guess we're counting
with
WNBA.
With all due respect to the Storm.
Or, yeah, right.
But then, yeah, it would be very different.
I mean, it was already, let's face it, kind of a what mentality?
Loser.
Loser, pitiable, loser. Whatever you want to call it. I mean, at least you had that. As long as it was, I mean, I was born in 1979, so I don't remember it as a resident here, obviously, or even as a sports fan.
Well, it was 40 years ago, so right. You got to be pretty old to remember it, even for residents here.
Right. Bob has no idea. He wasn't even born yet.
That's right. That's right. I got here just in time for their trip to the finals in 96.
Right. Did you remember 90? Yeah.
I was a little kid, but, you know.
No, you were born in 94, so you missed that early first round collapse.
Yeah, I was wearing a Sonics onesie in the pictures. I was told it was a great series with the Bulls.
You know, I mean, the Sonics maintained a great legacy, so I don't know that a whole lot would have been taken away. They had that great run in the 90s.
I was saying to Constance the other day, when the Mariners were playing the A's, I love the A's green and gold uniforms. Love them.
Classic.
I think
the 70s
they are.
Look.
Yeah,
you like the white cleats.
I like every variation that they have. I like the 80s and 90s look. I like the 70s. I like it all. But her reaction to that was, "Oh, they look like the Sonics." I'm like, "Yeah, they do look like the Sonics." The Sonics had some.
Say
of the
that
best...
like it's a bad thing.
Well, she thought it was a stupid observation on my part.
Wait, what?
They look like the Sonics. Yeah, okay, they kind of do, and I thought the Sonics had a great uniform,
too. They did. I don't get the negative there. What's her problem?
Just one of those things, you know. Okay. She was probably just sick of me.
I thought it was a stupid observation. What a dumb observation.
You like the elephant logo the A's use sometimes?
Do they ever put it on the jersey, though? Just on the side, right?
I think they've had it on the side.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure what it means, but yeah.
I remember.
The connection to the Athletics.
It goes back to Philadelphia,
right, I would think. Is that where they play? Shibe Park?
Shibe Park, your boy Connie Mack.
Curtis walks in just in time.
Player
for the
owner
trivia.
For 50 years,
but yeah, I thought the Sonics, I think green and gold just works. I thought the Sonics had great uniforms that really back in the 70s, 80s era, and then right before they left.
Yeah,
I thought those were their best look.
Somebody texting in, "Hey, I was at the parade. Don't call me old."
Yeah, all right. Hey, you know how I feel about my elders. I respect them.
Was that parade? How did that compare to the Seahawks parade? Just in terms of attendance.
It's been estimated about 250,000 to 300,000, so, you know. I mean,
and the size of the city was less than it is now.
Much.
300,000 might have been the equivalent of 700,000.
I would say that's accurate. I'd say it's probably the equivalent.
A little less than half
of
what
people,
the Seahawks was. What was the Seahawks?
Oh, less than half, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the way it must have felt at the time.
Right. Yeah, certainly. It was 40 years ago, this city. I mean,
yeah.
You didn't have all the tech industry people moving here and everything.
No, you had Boeing and nothing else.
Was there a tech industry? I mean, Microsoft was just getting started.
I think a billboard had gone up by 79 that said, "For the last person leaving Seattle, turn out the lights." Because Boeing was doing really poorly at the time.
Somebody said on the text here, the A's elephant arose when they were described as, quote, a white elephant nearly a century ago.
Yep, Philadelphia.
A white elephant. like the white elephant in the room?
I'm not really sure.
The white elephant here is that we're going to move the team 16 times.
Yeah, no, that's the elephant in the room. I'm not sure what that is.
Strange.
Yeah. And by the way, for the record, I don't think that was a stupid observation by you.
That the A's have good uniforms?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do.
You like the white cleats?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's whatever. Most people will rip on them for white cleats. I love
the look.
Yeah, man. I agree with that uniform perfectly. With the green socks
underneath. Credit to Charles O'Finley, man. He's the one who came up with it. Paid guys to grow mustaches.
Did some good, too.
All right, that does it for us. Thanks to our guest, John Clayton, for joining us on the program. This week's edition of Get in the Cage will feature Damon Martin, who writes for UFC.com. We're going to have that up there for you as well. So all of that is available for you on the podcast page, 710sports.com. Click the podcast button and click on our picture, and it's all right there for you each and every day. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back with you on Monday right here with Bob Gross and Tom.
A role play group? What would a... What was...